Anyway, 12 minutes past the hour of 8, David Abramson, psychologist in private practice, joining us in studio to talk about anxiety. But once you've danced to YMCA, there is no anxiety.
It's like in Cape Town. You just turn to look at the mountain.
And you're done.
There are no psychologists in Cape Town.
Certainly no successful ones.
Yes.
Right, drug dealers, maybe a few. But psychologists, not really,
no,
hey?
Just look at the sea.
And if it's not working, look at the mountain.
Turn to the
mountain.
Right,
and then you're, you know, for additional therapy.
Absolutely.
Right, but David, jokes aside, our kids are stressed. Our kids are anxious. I see it everywhere. I talk to friends who are telling me that their 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds are experiencing anxiety. 9-year-olds. First of all, let me understand this. Are there specific ages as our kids grow up that when they are more vulnerable to anxiety than at other times?
Mm-hmm. I think kids are generally, as soon as they start to, kind of be aware of the world and, interactions between people, and events, absolutely are susceptible to anxiety. So really, it can be from a very early age and, can be caused by a variety of different things. So it really, I see it happening.
So there isn't a specific age because, you know, people often say, oh, well, you know, at 6, they're dealing with the concept of death. So maybe they're anxious about that. And at 9, they're dealing with, you know,
Well, I think there is in particular when you get to, a stage where you start to realize, early on in life where you start to see the idea of life and death. That's definitely something that I see that, kids start to get anxious about, you know, the fact that they could lose, you know, someone very close to them, or even starting off with a pet, that this idea that one isn't on the earth forever, and that it is, and can be unpredictable is often, you know, something that I see. You know, interestingly enough, you know, when young kids are taught about, Mashiach, mm-hmm. that's very confusing at a very young age because this idea of, you know, people coming, who are dead coming alive again is very hard for a young mind to really, you know, conceptualize. So absolutely from those younger ages.
So that's interesting. So religiously, if we're talking to our kids about the Messianic era and the coming of Mashiach, of the Messiah, that is very anxiety provoking because it forces them to deal about people coming back from the dead.
And that's unbelievably scary. It's very hard.
It's interesting because I have often heard little kids saying, but what they're going to wear and making it very, practical and real and worrying about those sort of things.
So I always think, you know, and certainly I'm not a religious leader or a rabbi, but I certainly believe that from a psychological point of view, that kind of discussion can wait till the later grades because again, this idea of what's real, what's not, you know, what's fantasy, what's reality, is very difficult for young minds. So it's interesting you bring that up because I think for me, from a young age, that is specifically, you know, something that they do struggle with. But absolutely.
Is there a way to deal with that?
Well, I think rather to try and avoid bringing those things up when we can.
What, don't talk about the Mashiach, Messiah.
Yeah.
David.
It's such an early age.
What's early?
Early would be like 5.
Just
wait a little bit. But interestingly enough, you know, we have things on the internet where older kids get absolutely freaked out, for a want of a better word, so anxious. You know, we have these things popping up, these horrible characters popping up. I'm trying to think of the name of the recent one. It'll come to me with an M. Where it pops up on YouTube and it's a very scary caricature.
Right.
And kids much older, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 can, you know, have nightmares about this face. And then the rumors that go around about it, you know, like that this will tell you to, take the lives of other children.
Oh my gosh.
And the rumors just, you know, feed on themselves.
Perpetuate.
So I think for me, it is common that, at certain ages, certainly starting very young,
right.
that we need to try and help kids to differentiate from, you know, what's reality and what's kind of fiction.
Right. Okay. So let's just start right from the beginning because, Unsigned is saying genetics also is important amongst Jews. How much of a predisposition do our children have, not our children, but do our children have to anxiety, you know, obviously if the parents have suffered from it? Is that because, you know, would our kids suffer from anxiety because, if we do, we pass that on to our children through nurture because we're anxious about everything. Have you done this and have you done that? Mm-hmm. And if you don't put on a jacket, you are going to get a cold, and wear your shoes and where's your, you know, and we perpetuate that anxiety. Or is this a genetic, do we have a genetic predisposition as well?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I think for me, we see, you know, and often when we take a history from the parents, we ask about genetic predisposition. So is there anxiety in the family? Is there depression in the family?
Do you still even need to ask? Everybody's anxious.
Well, yeah, that's why we're talking about it this morning.
I say that flippantly, but genuinely, we all suffer from some form of anxiety. I don't think there's an honest person in the world that will say, no, I'm not anxious. I mean, unless they really heavily medicate.
Well, I think the first point is, just to answer your first question, is absolutely, if you have a genetic disposition, if there's anxiety in the family, it does seem like there is more of a chance that your child, members of your family could experience heightened levels of anxiety. And of course, that's, it's almost like a seed that, potentially can grow, and be activated through life events, through life experiences. But the other thing is absolutely environmental factors. If you have, trauma, if you experience something traumatic, that absolutely can, cause a reactive anxiety. So, for example, if you get bitten by a dog, you're scared of a dog. If you get in a car crash, God forbid, you get scared to get into cars. But sometimes, which is very frustrating for parents and adults when they experience it, they'll just say, my child is anxious. And it can go anywhere. It can suddenly they are anxious of, you know, to sleep alone at night. But yet the night before they got up in front of 600 people at school and performed. It's nonsensical because the anxiety decides, if you want to kind of personalize the anxiety,
by the way, Jenny and Ian both telling me the character David is referring to is called Momo.
Momo, thank you.
Kids have been told to kill themselves. It's so evil.
Absolutely. And
so it's really a bad thing.
Absolutely.
It's not just that they've created anxiety around it. This is a horrible little story.
That's right. Thank you. Because it is. It's called Momo, and it's like a witch-like caricature.
Oh my gosh, I'm scared now.
And it does. I see children, you know, who say they'll just pop up on YouTube and it will talk to you and persuade you to kill yourself or, you know, to kill someone. And it's absolutely frightening, you know, to think about that.
Pretty sure.
But I think, you know, the point is that, you know, that there is biological predispositions, and environmental, effects can then lead to anxieties.
Will we always find a trigger? In other words, you're saying that it's almost nonsensical. A kid can stand up in front of 600 people one day, and the next day they can't walk, they can't go to the bathroom on their own. Is it important to find that trigger?
Well, I think for me, sometimes it's difficult to, you know, we can't understand why a child is anxious. And generally, that's, you know, there's labels for everything these days, which we can debate. I'm not sure if that's helpful or not helpful to give people labels. But a generalized anxiety is kind of what we'd call that, when the anxiety can pop up, you know, in different areas at any time. But there are then specific anxieties, like, you know, separation anxiety. A child is.
So you might be able to find a very clear, nexus or link, a trigger, but you might not.
Right. And whatever it is, we have specific ways of dealing with it. And just to answer your question, Howard, I think two points. One is that anxiety, I think, often has a very bad name. If someone says, "Oh, you're anxious." Anxiety can be unbelievably helpful for people.
I think if we weren't anxious on some level, we'd be useless.
No, absolutely. And if you want to think of it, and I always say between 0 and 10, the most successful people that I see in the world and the most successful children often have an anxiety level of 6.5, maybe a 7.
Becoming a little anxious, because that makes us do things.
It does. It makes us it activates us. It makes us feel a sense of urgency. But clearly, when it goes to 8, 9, and 10, that's when anxiety becomes debilitating and absolutely is not helpful at all. But again, I just think that's an important point, that anxiety is not all bad. We need to feel a degree of anxiety to push ourselves to do things that we don't normally do, to extend ourselves, to have new experiences. But as we're saying, clearly, if it goes past a certain point and no one is debilitated by it, that's then where things become difficult.
It's 8:22. I'm chatting to David Abramson. He is a psychologist in private practice. We are talking about anxiety in our children. If you want to participate in the conversation, 34519 or 061-895-1019. And Science says a measure is that Dr. Pelkovitz's anxiety lecture at Sinai in Darba was packed to the rafters. And absolutely. Dov says anxiety, according to Sartre, is an existential phenomenon, i.e. it has to do with our perception or experience of values or lack thereof. That is from Dov, and a few people asking if there are specific triggers. And Science says, I'm an adult. I have bad anxiety. It feels like I'm in a boat and a big wave is coming 24/7. That's a terrible image, a frightening image of vulnerability, that you're on this boat and there is nothing you can do. Just knowing that this wave is going to come at any time.
You know, I think if you haven't experienced a real anxiety, and we've talked about it from 9, 10, panic attacks, it is absolutely debilitating. And, things like, and parents and often, say this to their children or we say to even to our friends, stop worrying. There's nothing to worry about.
The worst thing you can tell somebody.
Absolutely, because you're trying to be rational.
So it's interesting. I'll tell you my experience with it is after I had both of my robberies, and as you described it once, you called it a complex trauma. I suffered from quite a bit of anxiety that would come in a wave. And what I realized is, as terrible and as debilitating that this wave of horror was, it wasn't going to kill me. So what I actually decided to do, if I could, when it happened, was to lie down, simply to lie down and let this wave of horror pass through me and actually just get out of my system. I didn't fight it. It was almost like, if I take this image of this boat, almost that I knew that this wave would come, but I knew the wave would go. And as terrible as it was, I remember lying on a couch and actually having a physical reaction. I was sweating to it. My heart was beating fast. It was the most terrible, terrible feeling. And I just let it wash over me. And the minute I stopped fighting it and trying to control it and just accepting that it was going to pass in a few moments, that horror, or however long that would be, it actually stopped becoming such an issue for me.
Well, anxiety is exactly that. It's a fight between being in control and not feeling in control. So it's this constant battle in your mind around, can you control your environment? Can you control the situation versus not? And what you're saying is very, very important, because that's part of the treatment of anxiety, is actually to help people to put a face to it, to put a name to it, and not to avoid it, but to actually address it. So with children, for example, a very, very powerful way of dealing with it is to create or externalize it by creating a character. And we call it, so for the young kids, I can't mention it on air because we say call it a terrible name, maybe the lesser ones, stinky and smelly, you externalize it. And we make it the enemy. We make it almost like a bully. And you fight it, and very importantly, for example, if a child is scared at night, and they're scared that something's going to happen to them, to say, right, we're going to fight this worry part of your brain. It's lying to you. Who loves you? Your mom and dad, and they will tell you when to worry. But very importantly, to point out the corrective emotional experience. And what do we mean by that? And I think that's what you're talking about, where you are lying there and you let this worry wash over you and then nothing happens, is the corrective, and that's your corrective emotional experience to actually see that anxiety has no legitimacy. And same thing for the child, for example, that we're using in the morning, to say to the child, so what happened? Who lied to you? Was it, you know, what actually
interesting.
So that's why it's...
And do we use the word anxiety with our children, young children under 10? Do we say, are you feeling anxious, you know, or do we risk by doing that perpetuate the same, perpetuate it even more?
Well, it depends on the child. Some children are beyond their years, you know, and children these days seem to be so much more aware and so much more knowledgeable. But children who are younger, we tend to want to say that worry part of your brain, you know, that lies to you. You know, we want to say there is good worry and mom and dad will tell you when to worry, but there's also that lying part of your brain. But as they get older, you know, children would look at you and go, you know, this is not smelly. This is not stinky. This is anxiety. And absolutely, we need to call it what it is. We call it, you know, the anxiety.
At what age do you do that? At what age is obviously child dependent.
Right.
But at what age do you think that we can start talking about anxiety to our children?
Yeah, it can be as early as 8, 9,
right.
10.
Okay, but within that age.
Absolutely.
Within that age.
Absolutely.
Group.
Because I think sometimes, you know, there comes a time where we call a spade a spade, and you know, and we have to start using that word anxiety, because we're not doing our children a service by trying to, you know, make it something that it isn't, like when they are younger. So again, then
and my worry as well is you know, if a child's a little bit older and understands, perhaps they could use that as a little bit of a manipulation. Mm. Mom, I'm feeling anxious. Mm. Can I do A, B, and C? Mm. You know, how do you deal with that? Because parents do know if their kids are feeling anxious or not, sure. No matter what they say.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think in those situations where a child has been anxious and they're starting to feel more in control, we do get situations where, you know what, if I go to school, if I sleep in my own bed, you know, can I get that PlayStation game? Can I, you know, and again, you know, obviously we've got to be very careful that it's not used in a manipulative way.
Right.
But at the same time, we need to stress that anxiety can be absolutely debilitating. And I've seen, young people hallucinate, and they are not losing touch with reality as such. It is driven by anxiety. So anxiety can be debilitating beyond. So we, at the same time, yes, it can be used at times for manipulation, sure. But I think, again, I think the message that I would like to put out is that it's a real, real, you know, situation for someone that just feels, as the listener said, completely overwhelming, even if it doesn't seem to be based on something that makes sense. You know, it's not so bad. It's not so, for that person, it feels completely debilitating. And that's why it's so important for us to empathize with someone who's anxious and try not to be irritable. You know, you go to, we'll use the example, you go to a lovely school, you've got lovely teachers, you're coping with your work. There's no reason to be anxious. And it's true. And that's the frustration, is that anxiety doesn't have to be...
So that doesn't work as an argument, you say?
No, and I think...
As a strategy?
Well, I think for me it does, to a point where we are saying, let's look at the reality. Is there a real reason to be worried? You know, if there isn't, that's a good start. But very importantly, and obviously within reason, you know, if we and that's where we talk about exposure. It's so important to have a corrective emotional experience. But, you know, we need to do it very carefully. If a child, for example, is scared to go to school and he's petrified, he's vomiting in the car, is climbing up trees, you know, to throw them into school for the whole day, you know, could be overwhelming, completely overwhelming. Mm. So about understanding that, look, let's go taste a bit of school. Let's go sit in the library. Let's go sit at the play in the computer room for a few hours, then come home. Give them a little taste of the corrective emotional experience.
Time is 8:30. I'm chatting to David Abramson, psychologist in private practice. We're talking about anxiety. Couple of questions. We're going to go to news. We're going to go to music. When we come back, I would like to address some of them. One particular question is, when or how old does a child have to be before you start considering? All right. I'm chatting to David Abramson. He's in studio. We are talking about anxiety in children. Jenny says children also exposed to anxiety causing factors such as news information overload. Parents protected us from that. They were able to censor the information that we were exposed to. What do you think about that?
Absolutely crucial point. I think, you know, normally we would say, you know, if you are anxious about a situation, get information about it, get the facts.
Mm.
But these days, and I agree completely with Jenny, we get, kids have availability to too much information.
And it's very hard, very, very hard to manage it.
It's very difficult. I mean, you know, what happens in your house, absolutely, you can try and, you know, put everything in place. But you know, your kids live in the world and you never know. You know, you go to a friend who's got an older brother, an older sister, maybe they don't have the same, limits and boundaries that you do at home. And so, absolutely, it's so hard to regulate that. So they're exposed to so much information. And I always use the example of, you know, kids, definitely I'm seeing more and more kids worrying about plane crashes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure it's because there's, you know, there's programs on TV that you can just watch about planes crashing one after the other, and they're being, obviously they investigated. Mm-hmm. But again, it makes it feel like that's happening so much more than it really is. Or, you know, when kids hear about shootings at schools, overseas or in, movie theaters, we get this, anxiety, which they start to feel, even though it hasn't happened in South Africa. It hasn't even happened on the continent. So the bottom line is that, absolutely, I agree with the listener.
Okay. And another unsigned, before we get to the issue of medication, I sense that anxiety is far more prevalent amongst children these days, to when they were that age. Yes, we felt nervous and still just did certain things, but not to the level and the severity that kids seem to go through today. Mm-hmm. I guess it's the same question. Could it be fast food generation, all the chemicals in our food, or is it really social media, TV games, yeah, etc.
Well, I think it's a combination. I think for me, the pace that we live at is just extraordinary. And I think, you know, as I say, the pace of the information that we get, the pace of the communication that children have to, you know, or face, it's completely overwhelming. And then, you know, talk about the elephant in the room, I feel, is the education system, you know.
Why is that? Well, because we place too much pressure on our kids.
Howard, the education system, personally, and it's quite a controversial thing to say, I think, is broken. And, you know, we put our kids under so much pressure from such an early age, the testing and the excessive amounts of homework, you know, it's definitely leads to a high degree of anxiety or level of anxiety. So I think that also plays a role. So I think it's multifactorial, but, definitely these days, I think, kids are under so much more pressure from, you know, their schoolwork, education-wise, completely overscheduled, don't have enough time just to relax and not be on their screens. That's not the relaxation we're talking about.
Right, absolutely.
And so I think there are a number of factors. You know, we don't get to, just like the adults, we don't allow our children or force our children to switch off. And that's why, you know, going back to Shabbos is, Shabbos and Yom Tov, so brilliant, so brilliant.
Mm, because it forces into action between parents and kids. It forces everybody to just slow down. David, let's talk about medication for just a moment. How old, you know, how do you know, never mind age, how do you know when your child is a potential candidate for medication?
Let me first say, I mean, to put a child onto psychiatric medication is a very, very big step. And obviously it has to be done very carefully. It has to be thought out. You know, so I think that's the first thing to say. You know, it's not taken lightly, but I think, you know, I think the first step is to put a child into therapy. And when a child is in therapy, obviously we want to give them the skills, as we've been talking about, to try and help them along with their parents and along with the people around them to empower the child to fight the anxiety. But there are situations where a child is absolutely debilitated by the anxiety.
So you almost can't deal with those issues in therapy because they are just overwhelmed by it.
Well, when a child is having a panic attack and you're saying to the child, listen, you're going to therapy. Why aren't you doing what we told you to do? And it's like very similar to what the listener said. It's like this wave. You know, when you have a child who is petrified, who is actually not rational at that point, to expect them to say, listen, okay, let me be rational. Let me fight that worry part of my brain. Is school really as bad as I think it is? Is, I'm going to say, almost impossible. And that's where medication comes in, to lower the anxiety from that 10 out of 10, 9 out of 10, 8 out of 10, to a 7, a 6.
So that you can actually deal with these things.
So that you can actually deal with them.
And ideally, you don't want to lower it right down to 2, because otherwise you've got a zombie.
Absolutely. No, we've got to, and as I say, I think for me, I would always say that if you're going to or considering putting your child on medication, I think we have the most amazing GPs in this town. Unbelievable. But I do think it's important to go to a psychiatrist who deals with medication day in and day out.
And specifically children.
Specifically children.
I mean, I agree with you that every adult, every person that goes on any form of psychiatric medication should go to a psychiatrist. Mm. I have a very, very fervent belief about that. Mm. I think, as you say, as wonderful as our GPs are, they shouldn't be prescribing this type of thing. But even more so then when with a child, go to a pediatric psychiatrist.
Absolutely. You know, it really is a super speciality. And if we've got specialists, then let's use them, you know. And I think for me, excuse me, we're at a point in, and I've said this before, psychiatry where we're not quite at that point. We're actually far away from that point where we know exactly what's going to work, which medication is going to work at what level. So it does take a lot of experience, and psychiatrists work with these medications all the time, which gives them that experience.
All right.